Where it'll be cloudy and breezy with outbreaks of rain for most of Saturday, highs of 7 to 9 Celsius. Sunday will be wet again across the far north of Scotland. Elsewhere across the UK may start off cloudy, but it should brighten up and it'll be a touch warmer on Sunday, 13 to 18 Celsius. Monday's warmth could peak at 21 to 23 Celsius, where we see some sunshine, most likely across eastern England. That's the forecast. It's back now to Zeb Soames.
Thanks, Alex. Well, now our book of the week. In 1997, Margaret Thatcher invited Charles Moore to write her biography, on the understanding it would not be published until after her death. Today, it's May 1982, and a diplomatic solution to the Falklands crisis is looking increasingly unlikely, and military action would seem to be imminent. Nicholas Farrell reads the final extract from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography.
Mrs. Thatcher went to bed at 2 a.m. on the night of the 18th and 19th of May 1982 and rose at 6:30. The Daily Foreign Office Situation Report, produced at 7:30, informed her that the differing units of the task force have now joined up. A telegram from the British ambassador to the UN reported that Argentina had in effect rejected the British final offer, and the UN Secretary-General accepted this as fact. The War Cabinet, meeting on the morning of the 20th of May, decided that the military operation would go ahead as planned. The full Cabinet then heard from Mrs. Thatcher. All agreed that Britain had been strung along enough, and no one jibbed at the idea of landing. Lord Hailsham captured the situation by saying, "We are where we always expected to be. Now it's military." In Parliament that afternoon, Mrs. Thatcher set out the British proposals, which Argentina had rejected, explaining that, as a consequence of rejection, they were no longer on the table. This had been the seventh set of proposals, she said, and Argentina clearly was not serious about any of them. The tactic of publishing the British proposals paid off. Those who had been arguing for a negotiated settlement were forced to admit that the British suggestions were reasonable. On the 21st of May 1982, British troops began to land at San Carlos Bay. The location for landing was in some ways an odd choice. San Carlos Bay was 50 miles from Port Stanley, which was therefore very hard to reach over the wet and roadless terrain. But the site was rightly chosen. As well as being too remote for the 10,000 or so Argentine land forces to defend in any numbers, San Carlos Bay offered the best protection from attack. Nevertheless, air superiority would not be achieved in advance. Brigadier Julian Thompson, the commander of the landing force, had emphasized early on that the politicians should be quite clear that if we are ordered to land without air and naval superiority, we risk very heavy casualties. Mrs. Thatcher was as clear as Thompson could have wanted about the risk, and in agony about it. The start of actual operations left her superfluous to requirements and extremely anxious. On the day of the landing, she kept a series of engagements in her Finchley constituency. At a constituency office, she learnt, in concealed language, that events had happened, but no more news. Then it was given on TV, and the emotion at a reception at Woodhouse School that night was overwhelming. The Union Jack was flying in San Carlos Bay. We had returned to the Falklands. My heart was full, but desperately anxious about casualties. We had landed on a hostile coast, on a winter's night, with a fleet of ships full of men and equipment. Was it possible we had not been detected? She returned to Downing Street, where cheering crowds had gathered. There, John Knott informed her that there had been no casualties on landing, but the situation had grown worse in daylight. HMS Argonaut and HMS Brilliant had been badly damaged by air attack, and the frigate HMS Ardent had been lost, with 22 men dead. Despite this, it was, wrote Admiral Woodward, one of the most successful landings in military history. This was true, but the protracted business of unloading gave many more opportunities for Argentina to attack. Mrs. Thatcher was in a fever of impotent anxiety. "You couldn't find me some decisions to take, could you?" she asked Robert Wade Geary, secretary to the War Cabinet. "I find all this waiting around very difficult." On Saturday the 22nd of May, she visited Joint Headquarters at Northwood to see what was going on. This did not please Admiral Fieldhouse, despite his excellent relations with the Prime Minister. "Keep that woman away," he said to Wade Geary. "I've got a war to fight." When she was at Northwood, Mrs. Thatcher was sufficiently worried by the Argentine air attacks to ask Fieldhouse, "Can we still win?" In writing her memoirs, she did not want such a strong expression of doubt recorded. Instead, she quoted herself as saying, "How long can we go on taking this sort of punishment?" Favoured by clear weather, the brave and skilful Argentine pilots began numerous daring attacks on the British forces, reaching maximum intensity on the 24th and 25th of May. The burden of repelling Argentine air attack fell heavily on the Sea Harriers with their Sidewinder missiles supplied by the United States. "Without the Sidewinders," Mrs. Thatcher wrote, "we could not have retaken the Falklands." On the evening of the 25th of May, John Nott came to tell her that the destroyer HMS Coventry had been bombed and was sinking. Later, the duty clerk reported that the Atlantic conveyor had been hit. There was even a false report from Argentina that Invincible had been struck. Dennis Thatcher walked into the bedroom that night to find his wife sitting on the end of the bed, weeping. "Oh no, another ship, all my young men." He sat down beside her and said, "That's what war's like, love. I've been in one. I know." Once the task force was landed, the greatest fear for the British government was no longer a negotiated settlement, but international pressure for a ceasefire. It would have been intolerable for Britain to have had to stop fighting with only a toehold on the islands. The War Cabinet wanted a move forward, and if it was not possible immediately to close on Stanley, it wanted a visible victory. An attack on the Argentine garrison at Goose Green seemed to fit the bill. Colonel H. Jones, commanding Tupara, discovered on approach to Goose Green that the task was more formidable than expected, but decided to attack all the same. The Battle of Goose Green, which went through the night of the 27th of May, was fierce. As dawn approached, Jones decided to break through by leading the assault in person. He was killed. After fighting for much longer than the British had expected, the Argentines surrendered. They had lost 45 dead to the British loss of 16. There was now no real doubt that Britain would win the war. British troops prepared for the final assault. On the 8th of June, the Welsh Guards arrived at Fitzroy on the way to Port Stanley in two ships, Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram. Due to various confusions, the ships did not unload quickly. Argentine planes attacked and hit both ships. In all, 49 men were killed, including 39 Welsh Guards. "There are if-onlys throughout life," Mrs. Thatcher wrote. "And if only the men had been taken off and dispersed first, the casualties would never have been suffered to that extent. General Moore was grief-stricken. I was up at Northwood a day later. We all felt, how many more?" As British troops conducted their remarkable yomp on foot across East Falkland in order to recapture Port Stanley, there was very little left for Mrs. Thatcher to do. Characteristically, she busied herself with the details of the Trooping the Colour. It took two more days for the reconquest to be complete. On the 14th of June, Sapper Hill, the last obstacle before Stanley, was secured. Britain now had to deal with more than 11,000 captured Argentine troops. In the course of the war, 255 British servicemen had died, 649 Argentines, and three Falkland Islanders. Given her natural caution, Mrs. Thatcher's normal reaction would have been to wait for the formal act of surrender before making any public statement. The news that the Argentine resistance had collapsed, however, was all over the media, and the excitement was intense. Crowds were gathering in Downing Street. The Prime Minister went across to the House of Commons to address the chamber. "After successful attacks last night," she said, "General Moore decided to press forward. Large numbers of Argentine soldiers threw down their weapons. They are reported to be flying white flags over Port Stanley." She explained that the surrender negotiations were in progress. The House cheered, Mrs. Thatcher recalled. In her room in the Commons afterwards, colleagues gathered, and Willie Whitelaw proposed a toast to her. "I don't think anyone else but you could have done it," he said. Anthony Ackland, permanent Under-Secretary to the Foreign Office, remembered, and she wept out of sheer relief. Dennis put his arm around her and said, "Well done. Have a drink." At midnight, she went home among crowds singing Rule Britannia, with whom she mingled. The consequences of Mrs. Thatcher's victory in the Falklands were many. The most obvious was the transformation of political fortune. Before Argentina invaded, only a few far-sighted supporters had imagined that she was likely to win the next general election. Economic news was still grim, and unemployment was rising. Her opponents assumed that the Falklands, like a rerun of Suez, would bring her down. The opposite happened. The Falklands War established Mrs. Thatcher's personal mastery of the political scene and convinced people of her special gifts of leadership. The war also proved her to be utterly genuine, in private and in public, as her speeches, writing, and private conversation reveal. She cared passionately for the cause and for the people involved. In this, her sex was important. She was the first female war leader with executive power in the British Isles since Elizabeth I, and the first ever in a democratic age. She felt a maternal, almost a romantic identification with the men who she was sending into battle. And they responded with a chivalrous devotion, a desire to protect her as a woman and as an embodiment of national spirit. The Falklands was a great occasion, and she rose to it. Mrs. Thatcher was aware of this. From it, she derived the self-confidence which, in some ways, she had previously lacked. In her mind, it helped to create the dangerous idea that she acted best when she acted alone. On the 12th of October, 1,250 representatives of the task force marched to Guildhall with a flypast of helicopters and aircraft. Then there was lunch inside. The top brass sat with the Prime Minister and the Lord Mayor at the high table, the officers and other ranks at the lower tables. When Mrs. Thatcher rose to speak, it was noted that, suddenly, before she could say anything, there was a standing ovation from the floor, started by the boys. When Mrs. Thatcher had quietened everyone down, she said, "It is I who should be down there, thanking you." The night before, at number 10, Mrs. Thatcher gave dinner for the Lord Mayor and about 120 of those most involved in the Falklands victory. In her speech after dinner, she quoted the Duke of Wellington, "There is no such thing as a little war for a great nation." She spoke of the spirit of the Falklands and went on, "Or is it the spirit of Britain, which throughout history has never failed us in difficult days?" So many people had been invited to the dinner that there was no room for spouses at table. Instead, they were invited for post-dinner drinks in the drawing rooms. Because all the main players in the Falklands crisis had been men, Mrs. Thatcher was the only woman at dinner. After the toasts which followed her speech and the reply from Lord Lewin, the Prime Minister rose in her seat again and said, "Gentlemen, shall we join the ladies?" It may well have been the happiest moment of her life.
Nicholas Farrell was reading the final extract from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography by Charles Moore. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.